I have something I ought to talk about and something I must tell you about. What I ought to talk about is the 1974 General Assembly of the United Nations. What I must tell you about is an encounter I recently had with the Russians, which is insignificant, cockeyed, and hilarious. We'll leave that as the icing and get down to the cake. It's been tea time talk for 10 years or more that the United Nations has been going downhill as a world organization able to keep the peace. Though if you challenge people to say why, you get only a confusion of vague replies. So I think I ought to say as clearly and briefly as I can why I think it's gone down. The overriding aim of the United Nations was firmly stated on the day of its birth in San Francisco 29 years ago, in the first sentence of its charter, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. And the way to do that, everybody present agreed, was to give the United Nations a force, a physical force, stronger than that of its strongest members or of any coalition of them. They said it all in one article of the charter, Article 43. It binds all the member nations to make available to the Security Council, on its call and in accordance with a special agreement or agreements, armed forces, assistance and facilities, including rites of passage, necessary for the purpose of maintaining international peace and security. These agreements were to be negotiated as soon as possible. Well, the simple, disastrous truth is that they have never been negotiated. No nation feels obliged to make available to the Security Council a bow and arrow, let alone the bulk of its armed forces. So the United Nations has never had the force to assert the authority it claims, because none of us is willing to accept an international verdict against our own national interests. I believe it's as unavoidably simple as that. So now to the session of the General Assembly that has just ended with such a menacing bang for the Western world. To put it as forcefully and fairly as possible, let's recall the annual assemblies of the 1940s and 50s and 60s. For 4 years, we had rousing meetings, much promise of much good to poor countries, and many expressions of peaceful intent among the powerful. But the Russians were a nuisance at best, at worst a constant threat to the independence of countries in the Middle East. They kept on using their charter right to veto every Security Council resolution that called for force or international action in any place that interested them. So in 1950, the Americans and the Britons got together and pushed through an assembly resolution giving the right to call for arms to the assembly, where the Russians' veto couldn't be used. Why were the Americans and the British able to do this? Because they were absolutely top dog at the time, and they could always count on the supporting vote of an actual majority, which was made up of what the Russians called our satellites and what we called all good men and true, namely Western Europe and the Latin American nations. Today, the UN, which started with 50 member nations, has 138, and the majority is made up neither of our satellites nor the Russian satellites. It's sometimes known as the Third World. It is, in the main, the poor countries of Asia and Africa. In this assembly, the Russians voted with them automatically, just to be sure the Chinese didn't monopolize the role of the poor man's friend. This year, for the first time, the new majority flexed its muscles because it was backed by the Arab countries, whose citizens may be poor, but whose leaders are rich enough to threaten our own wealth, if not to annex it. So the Arabs were the biceps of this muscle man show, and Algeria was the brains, or ideological guide. Together they managed to get South Africa actually barred from the assembly. They got UNESCO to deny money and cultural help to Israel, the first time a nation has been so blackballed. The Israelis, indeed, were battered and besieged and profoundly humiliated when the assembly president, an Algerian, ordered the chair on which Pope Paul had sat in 1965 to be taken from the storeroom and placed on the podium to honor the special invited guest, the guerrilla leader, Mr. Arafat. All in all, it was a humbling session for the white man, for Western Europe, for the United States, and for the Latin Americans, for all the old, reliable Western majority. The majority has swung to the black men and the brown men and the yellow men, and it looks as if the future of the UN were theirs to dictate. Well, is the rather indigestible piece of Christmas cake. Now for the icing. A few weeks ago, when I was in San Francisco, I had a call one morning inviting me to lunch with the Russian Consul General and his deputy. The invitation came from an unlikely host, a friend of mine, who's a lawyer, an affable gent, a Republican, and a first-rate golfer. He is indeed the chairman of the Championship Committee of the United States Golf Association. And he was throwing a little lunch for the Consul General at the golf club, not simply by way of convenience. Golf, he said, was to be the main reason for the lunch. Now, this was like being invited by a rabbi to lunch with the Pope to discuss stud poker. I accepted instantly. The co-host was a young American, a boyish type out of Disney, who is associated with his famous father in the most successful golf architect's firm on earth. Golf architecture is the art of designing and building golf courses and involves much knowledge of landscape, grasses, water drainage, engineering, meteorology, and sometimes, I feel, black magic. Let's call the young man Mr. Jones, for that is his name. He had recently returned from Moscow, where he and his father had responded to what must at first have sounded like an incredible call from the mayor of Moscow to build the first Russian golf course. The impulse apparently had come from a Soviet diplomat who'd been exposed to the West and become one mad golfer, the only Russian golfer of whom we have any knowledge. And curiously, he was not bundled off to Siberia to play golf with a little red ball and a snow sledge. Somehow he sold the mayor of Moscow on the idea. I don't imagine things are allowed to rest there. The matter went up to the Kremlin, and from all I could gather, Mr. Brezhnev gave the nod. Well, the Consul General turned out to be a rumply, wry-faced man with a puckish humor. When we asked him if the Russians would take to golf, he said, "You see, the Russian people like quick games." And somebody said, "Like chess?" He came back on the hop, "We like a quick win." He plainly and admittedly knew nothing, but he asked everything, and to help him with the rudiments, young Mr. Jones put on a lantern lecture with color slides showing rice paddies in Bangkok being transformed slide by slide into bulldozed open ground, ground laid with gravel and seed and soil, planted and eventually appearing as a pastoral golf course. And we went, so to speak, to Hawaii and Florida and Scandinavia, and in the end, to the four sites around Moscow from which they will choose the one on which to build the course. After that, the Consul General had to have a lesson in weaponry. "Golf," Winston Churchill said, "is a game whose aim is to hit a very small ball into an even smaller hole with weapons singularly ill-designed for the purpose." We went off in electric carts like a little motorized battalion to the 11th tee on this noble San Francisco Golf Club course, a swaying, rolling landscape of brilliant green meadows and hills towering with cypress and pine and eucalyptus. The 11th hole is a par 3, that's to say you're required to hit the green with your first shot and sink the ball with two putts. Our lawyer took off his coat, straightened his waistcoat, took a 4-iron, set up the ball, and stood to the ball. Offhand, I would bet 99-1 any time that he would hit the green. Well, he hit about 6 inches behind the ball, which rose in an unsteady arc and landed about 120 yards away in front of a deep bunker. "Dear me," he said with admirable restraint. "So," said the deputy consul, "the first pancake is never any good." Ignoring this gem of Russian folk wisdom, the lawyer set up another ball, and this time He was well up on the green. Now the Consul General was motioned to play. He too took off his coat, looked down at the ball, seized the club with a baseball grip, his two hands far apart, missed the ball at the first swipe, at the second fell just a little short of the lawyer's first ball. There was general applause. "A natural talent," purred our lawyer. "Please," said the Consul General. And then the deputy had a go, and he slithered the ball about 30 yards along the ground. "That deputy," one man whispered to me, "he sure knows what he's doing." We then all departed for the clubhouse, had our pictures taken, and the Consul General was given by young Mr. Jones a copy of an article that I'd once written on the origins of golf. Mysterious, this. "Why?" I asked young Jones. He looked over his shoulder to see if there was a CIA man behind a tree. "Because," he said, "don't you see, it reinforces the main argument." "And what would that be?" I realized then that the argument had come up in Moscow and that we'd kicked it around at lunch. It really touched on our main curiosity. Why should the Russian leaders, the gods of the proletariat, want to embrace such a capitalist amusement as golf? The Consul General had dropped more than a knowing hint that he knew it was a rich man's hobby. All unaware of why I'd been seated next to the Consul General at lunch, I hastened to disabuse him, with, young Mr. Jones later assured me, deeply moving eloquence. "No, no," I said, "that used to be so no more, even then, only in England and America, never in Scotland." "No? Why Scotland?" I painted a poignant picture, all the more effective because it was true, of little poor boys, barely able to walk, going off with their sticks and paying a few pennies to play the most hallowed courses on earth. "In Scotland," I said, "the people learn to play golf as simply as they learn to drink tea. And St. Andrews, the Vatican of golf, the Kremlin, is a public course. On Sundays they close it so that little old ladies and dogs and babies can frolic around, for it is a public park absolutely for the people." "No," said the Consul General. "Yes," I said. "What," he asked, warming to the people's sport, "will our people do? Will they succeed at this sport?" I was warmed up, too, by this time, I can tell you. 10 years from now, I declared, there had been a couple of stimulants before lunch, the British or American Open champion will be a Russian. 5 years from now, there will be a match between the best player in the world, Jack Nicklaus, and Nicholas III. "There was never any Nicholas III," said the deputy. "There will be," I cried, "and he will win." So I like to think that 1 year, 2 years from now, when Mr. Brezhnev stands on the first tee and declares the first golf course in Russia open, he will carry a note or two compiled from our San Francisco lunch, and he will proclaim to a vast assembly of the peoples of all the Russias, "So, let us begin to play golf, the people's sport." Happy New Year.